I'm Rachel, the creative director for Ram Dass's Love Serve Remember Foundation, and I'd like to welcome you to our Inner Academy, a virtual Dharma hall where our family of wisdom teachers will help you navigate your daily life by bringing ancient wisdom into a modern context. With over 200 hours of audio and video teachings, meditations, and practices from teachers like Ram Dass, Krishna Dass, Sharon Salzberg, Jack Kornfield, Roshi Joan Halifax, Joseph Goldstein, and many more, the Inner Academy is your core resource for finding balance, presence, and navigating the ups and downs of your daily life. The Inner Academy has guidance for every step of your journey. Choose from an annual or monthly membership and gain access to past and future courses, retreat replays, virtual community, and much more. If you've been familiar with Love Serve Remember Foundation for a while, you'll know that most of our offerings are given freely or on a sliding scale basis. So when you subscribe to the Inner Academy, you're paying it forward and bolstering our ability to continue creating accessible offerings for all in the future, as Ram Dass wished for us to do. Be here now and start your journey with Ram Dass's Inner Academy today. For more, visit ramdass.org/innerAcademy.
Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app today to get free delivery on your first three orders, while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Hey everyone, it's Mind Rolling back with me as your host, Raghu, and I have a delight today. I've got an old buddy, East Forest, Krishna. Hey, glad to have you. And then I have it's always a thrill for me, John Hopkins, whose music speaks for itself over many, many years, and we're going to talk about it, and these guys put together a track using some Ram Dass audio that is superb, spectacular. As soon as I heard it, there's also an incredible video that John's team put together, labeled Domino. And, well, I should say, Yes, Please. Let's put them in the mix as well. And that's all going to be available to you and linked up in the show notes and all that stuff. So, John, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Good to meet you.
So, I know of you because of Brian Eno, who I have loved for a long, long time, and all the way back to Music for Airports. And I was doing some things then that made that album and that music maybe saved my life in the moments where I was doing some wild extracurricular activity, shall we say.
You can say what it is. I think that's safe. Yeah.
Okay. Ethnogens. Okay. Way back in the day. And it's a real pleasure to have you on, and and this is something that I love to get from somebody I have not met before, which is, how did this all emerge from wherever you were brought up and all the causes and conditions that contributed to who you are now? And, of course, we're going to talk a lot about a subject that's very dear to you, which is the proper use, that's a little bit judgmental, the use of ethnogens as therapy, as transformational process. And but how did you even wake up to the fact maybe there's something else out there aside from what they've been feeding me in this culture? So, yeah, just talk a little bit about how you came up and where you're from and all that.
Yeah, sure. So, I was born in South London to a a loving middle-class family, music appeared like pretty much as I did, you know, with me. Within 2 years, I was improvising and playing around with toys and just showing signs of musicality. And my parents were very supportive, and they put like a little mini piano in the house when I was young, and I taught myself, and it just became an obsession. And you know, I think it saved them from my kind of slightly overly energetic self, because I had something to really dive deep into from quite an early age. So I didn't need quite so much attention. And then as I grew up, the real switch into that, that realization you talk about was actually cannabis. When I was about 14, 15, and there was obviously no framework or real education around the subject, because it was just forbidden, and that was that. And but I came into contact with some, and just started experiencing music in a completely different way. And suddenly, you know, I found some ambient stuff from, there was a German label called IQ, which made a lot of great trance and techno, and they had a little ambient offshoot label called Recycle or Die. And this was 1994 or five or something, when I first heard it. And it was this, you know, super long form tracks, lots of arpeggios and the kind of classic German psychedelia sound a little bit. But I just started seeing things, you know, in this combination of this wonderful music and cannabis. And, you know, my life at the time was a little difficult, because, you know, being 14 sucks anyway. And, you know, at a school, I was at a boys only school. Yeah, there's not much to say for that time of life, really. And I feel sad when I hear people say it was the best time of their life. For me, it was like, that's about as, you know, you're neither one thing nor the other, and you don't really know what you're doing. And, you know, you haven't yet learned anything, but you're starting to grasp the seriousness of life, perhaps. But so I didn't feel like there was much going on in my real world. And so I dive quite deep into music, and I consider cannabis to be a psychedelic, really, as far as taking the word at its meaning as mind exploring. And I found this other band called Osric Tentacles, who are like a classic progressive rock band, strongly influenced by Hawkwind. And, you know, I don't know, you're both smiling. Maybe you've heard of them, but
No, I love the name. It sounds like a progressive band. Yeah, that's right. Why I was like, that's perfect name.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, there's some incredible, I mean, anyone wants to check out what I'm talking about, listen to the song called Dance of the Lumi.
Say the band name again.
Yeah, Osric Tentacles.
Osric Tentacles. Okay.
Yeah, I have
we'll
to
get
credit
that in
them
the show
with
notes.
Yeah, I have to credit them with getting me started, really, because they're, you know, there's a lot of crazy guitar solos and a lot of long hair and that kind of stuff, but that wasn't what I was interested in. I was interested in how they use synths, and I'd never heard this use of analog synths before, and arpeggios, and it's an obsession that remains to this day, which is like the combination of electronic music and psychedelics or meditation. And so these guys kind of set me on this path, and I started having these insanely blissful experiences, you know, just combining cannabis with listening to this music. And it was a very solo activity. I would just dive in most nights on my own. And I mean, it wasn't really healthy, because I had there was no one guiding me. And I went pretty deep until it stopped working. By the time I was about 16, 17, this magic had kind of departed, and it was as if I'd used up my tokens almost, you know. There's like there's almost like a no entry sign in front of that. So I started to become, in fact, it started to become quite a negative thing. And I was realizing I was dependent, and, you know, I had to start looking outside of that. And it wasn't until I was 20, 21 that I actually became quite ill with a kind of chronic fatigue syndrome, or ME. And so I had this period where life had got on top of me a bit. And in that time, I started to think, well, I've got a lot of this, you know, I can't really do very much. So what can I learn that doesn't require too much energy? And I thought, I'll learn to meditate. And I went on to the...
That just popped in your head.
Yeah, it was just like, I'm the kind of person that should learn that. That's what I thought. And I remember very clearly this moment of just the internet was young then. This was 2001. You know, if you only had it, I'd had an email address for 3 or 4 years at this point or something. And I typed in meditation into Amazon and this book came up called Meditation as Medicine. I was like, well, I'm quite unwell and I want to learn to meditate. This sounds kind of perfect. It turned out to be a book teaching the basics of Kundalini Yoga.
Who wrote it? Do you remember?
Dharma Singh Khalsa, who is
a Sikh community.
Yeah, well, he's converted to Sikhism. He was, and he'd learned under Yogi Bhajan, who, mm-hmm. of course, there's some problems around. But the techniques discussed in that book are ancient. And with everything I learn, I separate out from, you know, there's no one kind of teacher. But I essentially started to reconnect to some of that magic that I found through those early cannabis experiences. And I gradually went to, I suppose, open my third eye just through this process of having a Kundalini sadhana in the mornings. And, you know, it's obviously that was 20 years ago. And but I just started to glimpse little touches of infinity here and there. And, you know, when you just those little cracks through, mm-hmm. you know, first. I was not really ready or interested in taking any entheogens at that point. I felt, you know, the idea of mushrooms at that point would have been terrifying. It wasn't until I was 27 and I kind of settled a lot more into myself and I'd written a lot more music and perhaps become a bit more confident generally that I started to think more. You know, when I saw friends taking mushrooms on a beach in Scotland, I thought I'll just, you know, maybe try a little bit of this. And what followed was a, you know, the kind of classic life-changing experience where you truly see nature for the first time. You truly, you stay at your own hands and you realize, wait a minute, I've got hands and what's I? You know, all that stuff suddenly hit me. And I kind of got set down that path for a little bit.
Mm. Well, I think we, the three of us have very similar experiences. Mine, you know, I've told a billion times on this podcast, but it was a real transformational moment when I actually went, when I was around the age you're talking about, with when cannabis and music really did it for you, was I was around that same age, more like 16, maybe 17, but it was John Coltrane playing with his quartet, and then he played My Favorite Things on the soprano, and I had that moment into the crack, whatever, the gap opened up for me, and music was always the dearest thing for me from a young age. I just didn't have the discipline like you did, both of you guys, to really learn an instrument and so on, you know, and I ended up being involved with music and producing and stuff like that. But yeah. Right, Krishna, with you, I can't remember if we talked about it, but yeah, music, the transformational quality that hit way, way beneath the currents of whatever we thought we were at the time.
Yeah. Well, it's making me think, I'm trying to remember too, and I remember there was different music that kind of hit for me hard early on, even like things like Bill Evans. I was really into him for a while, jazz guy. But I do remember some early experiences with music aligning with mushrooms in a very particular way that was a really big influence on what I do today. And there was this Israeli choreographer I met back in graduate school. And then when I was living in New York City, she would stop by randomly because I lived like in Soho in this tiny, tiny apartment, which means everyone's going to stop by to use your bathroom, you know, because you're like in the city. And she stopped by once and she was in the bathroom and she'd just been to this music store up the street near Astor Place called Other Music that I don't believe is there anymore. But they always had all this interesting international music that you couldn't find anywhere else. And of course, this is way before Napster or even let alone iTunes digital music. And there was this band, this CD she had called Mertz. It was this German, I don't know, this little like instrumental project. And I ripped the CD while she was in the bathroom and copied it without her. I don't know why. And then it actually became this really seminal record for me that I just kept listening to over and over again. And there was this one time I remember I was had psilocybin in my system. I'd just gotten to this concrescence of this place of meaning and music and the medicine. And yeah, it was very powerful. But, you know, other experiences since then. But I do remember that first one.
I have to, just thinking, John, about what you said, that it was later on when you were 27 where you actually started investigating ethnogens, starting with mushrooms. And you said, I may not be quoting you exactly, but you had felt that you had a real base, formed a wholeness within yourself, and I may be extrapolating a little bit, before you actually went in and delved into ethnogens, psychedelics. And I just think that it when you said it, it hit me as something that's a great advisal for anybody out there who is considering doing any kind of psychedelic experience, and to do it without, well, Ram Dass talked about, we had a whole movie called Becoming Nobody, and it was, you cannot become nobody until you become somebody. And I think that's a little bit of what, in a different way, you're saying the same thing. And it's a good advisal, I think, for people. You get centered in your being and feel a real connectivity with who you are as a human and who you are, what your purpose is in this life, et cetera, et cetera. So I just really love what you said there, and I think it's really important.
Yeah, I mean, I think as well, I would put a lot of that down to the process of learning how to breathe in a meditative way and learning, you know, learning the importance of a mantra or just learning to sit with yourself, you know.
Yeah, just learning to sit with yourself, yeah. Yeah,
if absolutely. Otherwise, it's just like you're diving off a cliff. You've got no idea what's going on at the bottom.
Okay, we've just spent 15 minutes rapping about all of this, and when we're talking about music here, and I hate to not share with the audience. So, and you guys will talk about it after. But basically, John has a new album that'll be coming out this fall, and the single on it is a collaboration with Krishna, known as East Forest. And using some piece of a talk of Ram Dass. And I don't even want to describe or say another thing. Here we go. We're going to play the track. It's debuting here on Mind Rolling.
As if in each of us there once was a fire. And for some of us, there seem as if there are only ashes now. But when we dig in the ashes, we find one ember. And very gently we fan that ember. Blow on it. It gets brighter. And from that ember, we rebuild the fire.
Okay, when I first heard this track, now we've been doing different things through our Soulland music series with various musicians, and most prominently is East Forest. And I won't get too far into the whole idea that he had and stuck to, because he said, I want to go over and just hang out with Ram Dass and I'm going to record whatever. I said,
it was more nuanced than that, but
you think?
Well, I like that.
And I said, what are you doing that for? You know, he's got aphasia. How the hell is that going to work? You know, and he can't explicate stuff the way he used to. Here, I'll get you also. Nope. And then, of course, you had sent me some material that made me realize, let's stop pushing whatever it is I thought it should be onto East Forest. So this wonderful record emerged, and we've been working with different people, and they've been using prominently also Justin Beretta, of Glitch Mob, has done a couple of beautiful meditations with Ram Dass, with his sonic atmosphere underneath. And then I heard what you guys did, and I was really struck. the sophistication of the integration, because that's not always easy to integrate what, in this case, Ram Dass, his words, his from his talk, his tone, his relationship with the audience, all of it was going on, to integrate a musical bed underneath that and have it be integrative is not an easy thing. And I was just struck by it. So, I mean, I just think it's an extraordinary track. Now I got to hear from you guys. How the hell did you... How'd you meet and how'd you put this together?
The way we met's kind of funny. It's Instagram through Anna, our dear friend, DJ Anna, who is such a sweetheart. And I met her, I don't even normally catch these sorts of things, but she had, I don't know, if she made a comment or something. And I was like, hey, your music is interesting. And we started connecting and worked on a track together. And she, I think, had mentioned, John, that you guys knew each other and that, I don't know if I was like, I'm a huge fan of John, or she said, John would love to chat with you. Whatever it was, I was over the moon. And then we started connecting. And Raghu, you had been asking me to explore doing something with older Ram Dass material. And as you said, the Ram Dass album we made was newer material. And that was very intentional. And I had never worked with actually a recorded sample of someone speaking that I hadn't recorded myself ever. So I had this sort of aversion to it, almost like I just want to paint with the colors that I have, like what's sort of given to me. But I thought, what the hell, let's give it a shot. And when we searched for a long time for a talk, and we found that talk from 1975, I believe he's at a Unitarian church in Massachusetts. And it was a long talk, about 2 hours, but he just felt so tapped in and so open. And I took out a lot of the religious specificity and took the 2 hours, and I probably put it down to, like, I don't know, 10 to 15 minutes or so. And John and I had been talking, and it really felt like if we're going to bring on someone to help with this and expand it to more audiences and a different voice musically, I couldn't think of anyone better than John. And so I sent him that talk and the idea, and then he went to Scotland, I believe, and said yes.
Did you cut up different parts and put them together, or did you take an... I never asked you this before, and I don't know the answer. Or did
we
you
did,
just take an excerpt?
I did the first cut, which was fairly drastic, and I even did some... I never told you this, John, but I did a lot of treatment to it, like denoising and stuff. And in retrospect, it's like I probably could have not, so that you had more latitude. Maybe you wanted more high end. And, you know, right now it is what it is. But then you cut it, and actually you put stuff back in, if I remember correctly.
Oh, really?
Yeah, you added, well, I made various cuts. I kept shortening it. And then you made a really wonderful decision to, like, kind of say, I think these sections need to be there. It needs to be a little longer.
Yeah, I mean, something I should point out is that I work in such a strange trance-like way that I often don't remember the origins of things. Particularly with this track, it was like this thing wrote itself. You know, it was so beamed in. But yeah, I remember receiving, I think you sent... definitely a longer file and then some shorter bits. And then I think I'm just such a big believer in just getting the audio in front of you. And what tends to happen first these days anyway, for some reason, tends to be the right thing. And there were sections in there which just, you know, just to start with that first line, beyond all polarities I am, it was as if for me that was always the start, even though it wasn't. But musically, that just had to be the start. And Krishna had recorded some wonderful other parts as a starting point. I love to bounce off things, you know, so whenever I'm about to collaborate with someone, I ask them to, if they're open to it, just to, you know, jam something out as a starting point. And whether I use all of it or not is unknown at that point. But he did these incredible vocals, which I immediately soloed and just put in this huge reverb, and that's what you hear throughout the track. And I sing along with them a little bit myself, but it's mostly him. And actually, just to talk a bit about the treatment of the voice, I love what you did, because, you know, I'm very much of the view that this track has turned out exactly how it was supposed to. And, you know, me and my engineer, she really worked quite a lot on the sound of that as well, just to, I mean, I love the tapey sound of it, but it isn't, you know, and I love the fact there's still some noise left, you know, and there's a few coughs in there. You can hear that there's an audience as well. Yeah. And I don't know, I mean, we tried quite hard to remove, I think there's two audible coughs. I tried to remove them and I was like, no, they're, you know, they're supposed to be there. This is like, this is the little check-in with the fact that he's talking to in a room of people, and it's beautiful and it's real. And, you know, on the album, this is the, it's the last track on the album. And there's a lot of, I love using layers of noise of different types, some natural, some unnatural. And it just felt like this talk, the sound of it, it's just exactly how it's supposed to be. And we tried to make it, just trying to make the voice. I mean, I think it came out slightly higher pitched than he actually spoke it. So I dropped the pitch down a bit from the tape.
And, tape machine, That was you caught that. That was really slick. And you dropped it a little bit, and I was like, oh, there he is. You know.
Yeah, it was a semitone. Yeah. So it's quite a meaningful amount, which meant that when I first heard it, it was like, he sounds quite shrill. And I thought, that's not the voice I have heard before. So it was just like, and then it's down one semitone. It's like, that's exactly it. Mm. And then once that started clicking, it was like put the vocals behind. And then there was this really potent moment that I'll never forget, which was, you know, I wasn't in this studio. You see, now this studio was not yet built at this point. This was last October, I think. But this piano is the same piano that you hear on the track. I was just like, I had this feeling that as soon as I started playing that first take, that would be it. And that's exactly what happened. So, what, you know, I had the talk playing in my headphones, these headphones. And it's like, I don't know what chords are going to come out. I'm going to wait until it feels like it's time for a chord. And then, and that was that, you know, and what you hear is what came out. So it was like a strange kind of interplay between a talk recorded many years ago and something happening there and then. And I've just learned over the years, particularly when making this more spiritually inclined music or like fully spiritual music, that if it's right when you start, then don't mess around. just go, just, you know, the tweaks I made were very small. Just sometimes it was like more space between his cadences or his paragraphs, and sometimes it was allowing a bit more room for the other instruments, but generally everything just, it really just landed. So in a way that I perhaps haven't experienced before.
And you know that when you hear it. I mean, as soon as I heard the song for the first time, the track, I said it before introducing it, whatever, the integration of it is absolutely phenomenal. And you get, I pretty well knew you guys just went into the, I didn't know, you know, what you're doing now and telling me the construction and so on, but it was obvious that the integration was immediate, and it was one of those things beyond I'm doing anything.
It was one of the first times I also had rearranged Ram Dass. I kind of had this golden rule with the original record. It's like, well, I'm very careful about the order that he said something in. And when we were in Maui recording, it was so concise what he said because of the aphasia and his age. It was really, there wasn't a lot. It was just perfect. Mm. But with this talk, there was so much. And it really became like, there were kind of three different ideas in that talk that we are in the song now. And it was sort of like moving things around, deciding like what should be the opening line and, you know, what's the through line. And that was a whole different sort of editorial hat to put on that I was sort of not comfortable with, but needed to be done because it, I think one of the great things about working with Ram Dass and his words is finding in some ways the smallest parts to get the point across, you know, give it the spaciousness to land and the music to swim around that and not for it to be too much or too loquacious. And so that was an interesting challenge in this. And John, I thought you did just a fantastic job of supporting, you know, the meaning of what he was saying.
Yeah.
Yeah. And there was, I mean, appreciate that. There was no conscious thought applied to that. And, you know, it's like there's a different part of me kicks in. And I'm sure you know this feeling as well. I'm sure you both do, where you just like, I'm getting out of the way of this. And you just see yourself doing these changes and you're like, whatever it is you're working on. And, it was really clear in that way. So I just kind of got out of the way, really.
It's the hallmark, a bumper sticker for any artist is, yeah, just clear out of the way. Yeah, absolutely. Can we, I just want to switch gears a little bit, just because, you know, you've been done a lot of work with Brian Eno, and I just, how did that all come about, and what was that like, and so on? And we'd like to hear a little bit about your that part of your life.
Yeah, sure. So this was, I think I was 23, and it was one of the great synchronicities of my life, the first really clear one, actually. It was a guitarist friend that I have known since I was 13 called Leo Abrahams, who's on almost all of my albums and I've collaborated with on scores and just so many things. He's honestly one of the best guitar players I've ever heard, if not the best. And he was trying out guitars in a guitar shop, just playing quietly to himself, not aware that there was anyone listening in. And it turned out that Brian Eno was standing behind him, which is unusual.
It's good he didn't know, you know.
Exactly. And Leo had no idea and he just kept playing. And it was precisely, the way Brian tells it, was precisely because he wasn't playing anything flashy. He was playing something really restrained and beautiful and incredibly eloquent. He was moved to introduce himself. And Leo was obviously like, you know, I know who you are. It's amazing. And so they started playing together in Brian's studio. And after a year or so of that, sporadic jams they were doing, Brian said to Leo, is there anyone else you know you might invite into this situation and maybe would work well playing with us? And Leo was kind enough to think of me. And we'd been improvising together at this point for 10 years. And we'd been in a band together for an artist called Imogen Heap. That was my first job.
Oh, yeah.
And she's absolutely wonderful musician. And so we had kind of a very long history of playing together even then. And so I got this call from Brian and he asked me to come in and play with him. And the improvisations from that went on to form part of his album, Another Day on Earth, which was, I think then came out in 2005, which was his first vocal album in decades, I think. And then, we just went on to do a lot of other stuff after that. And the experiences, you know, I think the last time we played together was, it wouldn't have been last year, but 2019. So, I mean, it's been very regular. It'd be the odd year where we didn't do anything. But, you know, he brought me in to work on the Coldplay albums that he worked on. And that relationship has been long and amazing as well. Changed my life in many ways. And, you know, we released an album on Warp Records in 2010 called Small Craft on a Milk Sea that came from 2 weeks of improvisations between him, Leo and myself. You know, so there's a lot of stuff. Mm. We did live shows in Sydney Opera House, fully improvised with...
Can you, John, what's the name of that record again?
Small Craft on a Milk Sea.
I'm not familiar with that. Okay.
Yeah.
You guys make sure you get them in the show notes here, all of these links and, you know... I want to listen to it.
Yes, I mean, there's some very, it's very kind of polarized album. There's some very edgy, kind of tense stuff on there. It's all very filmic. But there's some very, very beautiful melodic stuff as well. And, you know, you can hear the three of us truly exploring things without any time constraint, you know. So it's this wonderful thing for me because when I'm writing music, it's a very intense process and I do everything apart from, you know, I have help with the mixing from my engineer and little things along the way. But essentially, I control everything like a freak. And with Brian, you just get to turn up and improvise for days and make loads of music very freely. And then he takes it away and turns it into something. And it's always, by the time you hear it, you're like, I don't even remember playing that. And it just feels quite...
That's awesome.
Yeah, it's an incredible privilege, really.
Beautiful. You know, and of course, and that album, the Coldplay, Viva La Vida, that you co-produced that with Brian. Is that correct?
Yeah, so this is another thing that came from that. I wouldn't say I co-produced the album, but I co-produced two of the songs on it, the opening and the closing song. And the reason that credit came about was because I played Chris a track of my own called Light Through the Veins, which wasn't released at that point. It came out in 2009 in the end, but we were working on this album in 2007. I was 27. And I just had this... I had this feeling that he would love this track, and he really fell in love with it and wanted to sing on it and open the shows with it, you know. So this was all like a huge, huge life change for me, and it's incredible to get the support of such a talented songwriter, you know, to bring obscure artists into the mainstream briefly like that and support them. And I opened their shows for them. I just did loads of stuff back then, and you know, we still work together to this day.
Oh yeah,
We still write together, and it's you know, all this came through Brian originally.
Yeah, lovely, amazing.
What,
yeah?
What a trip!
Yeah,
fortune. Oh, but that's the way things turn out. It's like the way you put together this song with East Forest and Ram Dass, the natural emergence of it, and the flourishing. Hopefully it gets translated to all the different parts of our lives when we all have that kind of a moment, no matter what we do. It's a beautiful thing. I wanted to play another track to give people an idea of some of your other work. And the one, you did a record called Singularity in 2018. Can you just talk a little bit about how that came about?
Yeah, so I think that was my fifth solo album. Just checking, that's right. Yeah, that's right. And
it got a lot of acclaim, right? That record got a lot.
It did well, yeah. It was top 10 in the album charts over here, which is pretty weird for an instrumental electronica album. It was a Grammy nomination over there, and... you know, a lot of stuff I never thought would be particularly available to someone making this kind of music. And but it came, I mean, this was the point, to go back to our earlier conversation, at which entheogens had crept into my life in a different way. So around, would have been 2015, just as I was starting to write this album, I finally became comfortable enough in myself to be curious and act on the curiosity about what DMT might be like. Mm-hmm. And I can honestly say it's not something I would recommend. I wouldn't recommend anyone take anything, of course, but this is, you know, I feel like I probably had my time with that experience, but it did change everything. And I'd been doing transcendental meditation for I think about a year at this point, and that was where I finally felt a even deeper connection, even deeper solidity within myself. And I was like, I can't imagine going through my whole life without having this experience, you know, having read a lot about it and watching the spirit molecule and all these things. Curious about the effect it would have on creativity. And this album was born out of those experiences, really. And in fact, it's only the beginning of that story, really, because the new album takes that and times it by 1,000. But Singularity itself was also, I realize in retrospect, was also very tailored for live performance. It was very much about getting people to dance and lose themselves in the trance state that comes with dancing. And there were some quite big catchy, danceable tracks on there. And that, you know, it was a lot of hard work to make that stuff work, and to still feel like it had that spiritual kind of that message running through it. And yeah, it's almost a battle between the technology, like actually trying to make that stuff sound fluid and work when the reality is that you're moving tiny things around on the screen, and it's not doesn't feel very magical at all times. But that's my relationship with that kind of drum programming. It's complicated. But there's some very quiet moments on the album as well. And so I like the idea of just almost taking those rhythmic structures like as a sort of a framework of as a canvas almost. And then you can paint what you like on that. You can be transmitting the same stuff, you know, using that as a framework. But yeah, it was a very long and difficult one to make, but yeah, it, like you say, it did open a lot of stuff up for me.
Yeah,
and gave
seminal.
Me some freedom.
Yes, very much a seminal record.
Could I interject something there, John? Because I think the track Sit Around the Fire single probably wouldn't have come about if it wasn't for COVID and like you essentially being home and having time. And on top of that, I remember at the time you saying like you were, when we first, I hope this isn't too personal, but you were just having trouble like sleeping, and you're just trying to get your center again after all the stuff you've been doing and the sort of more beat driven music. And I think that it was the perfect timing and alignment of where you were at in your life that led to like wanting to make and making a very spacious track like that. And that was somewhat an alignment of what was happening, is like one of the gifts of COVID. Of having that spaciousness in that time and a desire to create the feeling that came out of it.
Yeah, that's completely the case. And in fact, that applies ultimately to the entire album. None of it would be here. We wouldn't be talking had none of this, you know, happened. But that was, there was, you know, there's a whole section of the album, a 20-minute section based around an experience in Ecuador of living in caves, which is a whole other story. That one already existed. And then Sit Around the Fire appears October, November. And that was the point where I realized I might be writing an album. I wasn't really aware that I was writing an album at this point. And I was, yeah, it was kind of a magical thing when you realize you're quite a way into something.
Yeah,
it could be really important to you. Yeah, yeah.
Hey, you just ran over something like a throwaway, but I caught it. Okay, the caves in Ecuador. I ain't got to hear about the caves in Ecuador.
It's pretty incredible. I mean, I think so. Really, the genesis of this album is that trip I went on in 2018. So it was the year the Singularity came out, and I was invited by my friend Eileen Hall, who did the beautiful artwork for the album. Her father, Stan Hall, had made his living as an explorer, like genuinely just exploring, looking for ancient treasures and mapping places. And he was obsessed with these caves called the Taos Caves in the high altitude parts of the Amazon in Ecuador. And Eileen is very keen to carry on his legacy and keep. I think that the idea behind this expedition, which involved me and a neuroscientist called Mendel Kalin and photographers and artists and guides and tribes people, and it was, you know, incredible to meet people from the Shuar tribe who live in that area and have been, I believe, having ayahuasca ceremonies in these caves for many years. They were our guides. And the idea was that we would go and live in these caves, which is a 60-meter drop down. You know, that's the most terrifying thing I ever did. I didn't think about that bit in advance. Just like, okay, this is what's happening. The idea is that we would generate art and music and science really as well, neuroscience, about the effects of living in a cave on the brain and on consciousness and on meditation, and try and shine a little light on this place in our own small way, with the hope of protecting it from, you know, the usual kind of threats that these places are under, these sacred places, you know, mining and so forth. So I went down there, and my friend Mendel, who I mentioned, did a lot of field recordings. And so my job was to be down there in order to not to write anything down there, but just to absorb the atmosphere and to meditate on it and to return and make a piece of music. And because of all the aforementioned touring and stuff that came with Singularity, I didn't get the time to really sit with those recordings and devote myself to this project until 2020 as well. So, you know, I think it was June and I hadn't written anything. I was totally burnt out, and obviously like everyone was having a very anxious time. And I was just like, I had this brainwave one morning. It's like, I think I'm ready to write that Ecuador piece. And then in much the same way as the rest of the album, and also very much the same as Sit Around the Fire, this thing, I just put these field recordings into Ableton, my production software, and started improvising over them. And once again, it all just came, you know, in an absolute flood. And within 2 weeks, that whole thing was done. That's 20 minutes of music. And it's not a simple piece, but it was writing itself. And it was like, never have I felt so much just like a vessel. You know, this place was pouring its wisdom into the sound. And this is, you know, this makes up most of the first half of the album. And it's incredible hearing it back, because I don't really remember any of the techniques involved in writing it. It's like, oh yeah, that's what it felt like to be there. That's all I can say. That's the spirit of that place. So
You haven't shared that with maybe you did with Krishna, but
I mean, I heard it in an early form back when we were recording, I think, and it was actually an interesting influence, because look, I'm quite partial to field recordings and how they capture a sense of space. And so the fact that it was the central element was this extremely space specific recording was amazing to me. And I dove in deep on that one a few times. I still have. I love the feeling it has. It has a really beautiful feeling. It's sort of this ethereal expansiveness. Yeah.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, so this piece you can hear, like, it will be released with the album in November, but it is available on a sort of, I don't know how to describe, really, a kind of a website that's about these caves, called, if you look up the Liminal Compass, you can actually go in and there's all this stuff you can read, incredible images, and you can hear that piece in there. And so this kind of emerged before anything else was available to anyone.
Oh, so say it again, Liminal?
Yeah, the Liminal Compass. And I think the website is tayos.org, which is tayos.org.
Okay, great.
So yeah, that's on there.
I want to go there. I want to go there now. I want to play another track before we have to go. And I'll just say that I listened to this track. It's called Wintergreen from, it's an EP or something, Piano Visions?
Yeah, it's Piano Versions, and it's actually a cover of a Brian Eno and Roger Eno collaboration.
Uh-huh. Right.
It's a beautiful story. Roger is a great pianist, and he was playing these melodies on just straight to MIDI, which is, you know, which Brian would then take and then do the sounds for. So it's a beautiful, simple, but very evocative record. And I just wanted to do a piano version of that.
Okay, well, here's what happened to me, because I put it on this morning, and, you know, I was doing stuff, getting ready, know a little bit more about you for the podcast and everything else I'm doing in terms of all my work, and, you know, shall we say, a little bit of spinning was going on, and no matter that I did my practice, and I'm like, wait a minute, what the hell? And I was still unsettled, let's put it that way. And I put the track on, and it did the job, John. That's all I got to say.
Yeah, it's a good one. I have it on vinyl. It's a good one.
You do?
Yeah.
Oh,
my. It was given to me as a gift recently by Rada.
Oh, nice.
Amazing.
Oh, yeah. No, this... I mean, in all of the work that I've been doing, you know, since I first went to India all those years ago with Ram Dass and all that, and met Neem Karoli Baba, you know, the development of a spacious quality through meditative practice, through mindfulness, through whatever you do, mantra, whatever you do, kirtan, you know, reading a book, listen, it doesn't matter. The development to me of, for me, of spaciousness within the presence of moment, within be here now, is the easiest way to put it, is extraordinarily important to be able to navigate the day-to-day stuff. And, you know, we are getting thrown some, you know, really difficult stuff since COVID, since racial injustice, polarization in this country is enormous. And that is so evident in this track, that spaciousness with your piano playing, and I mean, and the composition itself. It'll be a go-to thing for me now. So I thank you for it, John.
Thank you. And thank you for saying that. And I think, you know, these pieces that I'm doing, particularly that piano version's EP and the new album, are getting more and more spacious as things around us get less spacious, you know, direct reaction. And this is how I cope with things. Yeah. And I think that to hear that anyone is also feeling some of that space through it is literally the point of it for me. So thank you.
And here we go. Let's, you know, everybody take a listen. This is Wintergreen from Piano Versions. Well, I think you all, everybody listening and or watching out there, I think you get what it is that I meant when I put this on this morning, and it just turned around my moment. And just delighted to have you here and Krishna as well. Just before we go, though, the album is called Music for Psychedelic Therapy. Am I correct?
That is correct, yeah.
And that's Sit by the Fire that we played earlier in the podcast. And that's, with everything that's going on, I want both your reflections here. Everything that's going on with, and the wonderful work that Rick Doblin's doing through MAPS to help create an atmosphere where this is going to get government approved, people will be able to carry on therapy without hiding in back rooms doing stuff with people and all of that, which is extraordinarily important. And so that you are providing that in it's just a poignant moment because so much of that kind of work is going on. And to have, for me, music is a guide post and to have that fit into the kind of work that many people are doing, I think is a tremendous accomplishment, John. Now, I haven't heard the rest of the album, and I'll probably be bugging you to get me in advance or something.
Of course. I'll send it to you.
But just talk a little bit about how this came about and what your own personal involvement with the title of this album.
Yeah, I mean, I think all of this comes from subconscious things. So it's almost like I'm the last to know what's actually going on, you know, conscious me, the ego bit of me or whatever is like, oh, this is what we're doing, is it? But for a while, it seems that a part of my brain has been thinking about this concept. And I have some friends who I met through the psychedelic world over here in London who had run the, you know, our psilocybin for depression trials, which of course you have over there at Johns Hopkins University, I believe. Mm-hmm. I'd just been talking with my friend who was running that trial about the playlist and what people were listening to, and we were sharing tracks and ideas, and I was just like, I think a part of my brain was like, well, you know, your experience psilocybin, for example, is not made up of lots of different 5-minute sections which come from different people. I feel like there's a genre here. There's a new, I don't want to call anything a new genre anymore, but you know what I mean. It's like there's a different kind of framework possibly that we can write in, which is longer form. You know, like I can't write 6 hours of this stuff yet, but the to sort of jump forward to when I was writing this record, it was ketamine that I was finding to be particularly powerful, and the length of time that experience takes is roughly the same as the length of the album. And the title appeared to me after a ketamine journey in which I was testing out some early versions of this track. It's like, oh, this is what I'm making. This is the name of the album. And it was like the most clear thing I've ever, you know, it's like, there's no question, you know, and if anyone has problems with it, I can't help, I'm afraid, because this is what it is. And then it all started to come together very quickly. You know, this whole thing was written really in about maybe the bulk of it, about 6 months, which for me is short. But the ideas go back throughout my life. But I just think that, you know, there's a lot of conversation about the legalization, and it's all wonderful, but maybe I'm biased because I'm a musician and also I'm in this area, but to me it seems like we should be talking about the music with almost equal importance, because you can't separate the two experiences. I don't know if either of you have read the Michael Pollan book, How to Change Your Mind, but he brilliantly details how he has I don't remember what medicine is, I think it's psilocybin, but he has an experience that is quite claustrophobic and unpleasant, and it's because the music that's playing is you know, a little dodgy, and then they change it to a beautiful Brahms quartet or something, and suddenly everything opens up. You know, and that's so it's the difference between, yeah, and he writes it beautifully, and it's the difference between the one and the other. You know, you've got to be hearing the right thing, and obviously I'm not saying it's gonna be right for everyone, but I've written what works for me, that's all I can do, or what comes through me maybe, with the hope that it will do the same thing for others. And it's an unusual thing to say about your own music, but when I was testing it out towards finishing it off, I was just like, I don't know where this came from, but this is the deepest thing. It's the deepest thing I've done, and I don't know how I did it. But there you go.
Yeah, that's so great, John. Really great. And of course, Krishna, I know you've been working in this area a lot.
Well, you took the words out of my mouth. I mean, that's my experience as well. And I just want to highlight that what you said about, at least in the psychedelic music space and therapy and this whole thing that's emerging, music is most definitely a bit of an afterthought. And it's a mistake, because not only traditionally, and we see this across the ages of indigenous ceremony, but the music really becomes the ceremony. It's the central guide. And it is not an afterthought. It's incredibly important. And so I really honor that you put something out there that can be used as a tool this way. And I agree too that right now the playlists that are out there for it, if you think about it, like all the songs on them, they're like, this is off-label use in a sense. Like none of them were designed with the intention. They might work just fine in different ways, but they're probably shorter. And more importantly, this hit me once on a journey. I was listening to a playlist someone made and going, I was ketamine journey at my partner's therapy clinic. And it was like every time a new song came on, it was like a different soul entered the space. It was like a whole new language. And I was like, all right, I had to reorient. Okay, where are we? Who is this? What kind of vibe? And then it would be over. And then there was another one. And I was like, oh, there's a real value to a single artistic voice carrying you from beginning to end. And it's almost this like modern hybrid of what the shaman or facilitator was. There's one person singing the Akaros or singing the Lakota Sweat Lodge songs. They may be different songs, but there's one voice. And that's something that had been missing largely in these modern offerings, which there are very few. So you're putting yourself out there in a way that's very needed. And I think there's value to that that is yet to be recognized.
Well, that's an interesting point. I mean, yeah, it's like, it's almost as if with a playlisting, you've got like a revolving door and you've got all these people totally. With their histories, their personalities,
like,
their lives.
Karma? Yeah.
Yeah. And I always, I don't know about you, but if I'm deep in an experience, I start thinking, who is this musician? I want to know about them. Yeah.
I feel it. And sometimes I'd be like, I don't know, something's off about this. I don't know what's going on with this. I mean, the music's okay, but something's off. I feel a little off.
Yeah. But it was crazy. But in some of the formative stages of writing these tracks, I would feel, I would test out on ketamine and test out where the tracks had got to. And if they were wrong and I hadn't noticed in my waking consciousness, I would notice in the ketamine space and it would be so extreme how wrong they sounded. And I realized it was like wading through sludge. It's just like this awful, so something's just a bit, and I'd come back with these realizations, like return from the ether with these crazy detailed notes about what's wrong and then rebuild it. And it's pretty cool.
Yeah, I know that feeling that you're talking about when you test it out and you're hearing something and the medicine allows you to separate where you're not sure how things were made anymore. And then it's almost like this bizarre experience of like yourself speaking to yourself, but in a way that feels it's the parts of you that are all of us, like the larger parts of us. And it's like much bigger than the self, the smaller identity. And you're just like, what is this wisdom that comes through that I don't even know how this happened?
Yeah. And why can't it be there all the time? Yeah, that's the other thing. Why isn't my waking life a bit more wise?
Which leads me to remind everybody about why did Ram Dass go to India? Because he kept coming down. I mean, he even went, I was just talking to my friend Ramesh Radas, who co-wrote the memoir that we just put out of Ram Dass earlier this year, Being Ram Dass. And there was one stage at which they were in Millbrook, and actually Leary wasn't there, but a bunch of them that were living in Millbrook went into a room with a pile of psychedelics, of all from STP to DMT, that acid, all of it, and just kept seeing what's going to happen. We could break through so that you wouldn't come down. Well, they ended up actually mostly after a while, no effect. you do it just zero. And they ended up like in a bickering war between them, some bullshit. It was like absolute. And that led Ram Dass, that was part of what led him to go to India looking for a map of consciousness, because he could not believe that, or he couldn't believe it. He just kept coming down. He didn't want to come down anymore. And so he got there, and there's, of course, the whole story of giving that acid to Neem Karoli Baba, who eventually said, this is good for beginners. It gets you, he said, it gets you into the room with Christ for a couple of hours, but then you got to leave. So eventually best to love everyone and serve everyone is what he said. But I would say, and we're talking, all of the conversation that we've had here, and I don't want to act like the school monitor here, but at the same time, Ram Dass in particular and Leary's thing about set and setting for any of these experimentations that any of us do, and particularly if you're just coming into it. And as John said earlier, he found a foundation that he was comfortable with inside himself before he started experimenting. That's extremely, extremely important. And so is if you're just moving towards this kind of experimentation, being with someone who's had some experience and a loving, an unconditionally loving being that can be your foundation and help pick the right music even. And that's, setting. And so this is just, I would be at fault, I would say, for if I didn't mention that this kind of care needs to be taken with these ethnogens. I won't say any more.
And that to be said, Music for Psychedelic Therapy, your album, there's nothing to say that can't be used off-label in itself. you know, you don't need to be on psychedelics to journey right. with it. Yeah. It could be just listening to it and breathing alone is quite powerful, let alone whatever else use. And I think that's wonderful to remember that it's music. It's beautiful music yeah. that's thoughtfully composed like any other. And some people like put things in a category as if it that now makes it just for that. And I disagree with that entirely.
Yeah. No, I appreciate that. And for me, it's like the going broadening the meaning back to what psychedelic means, you know, mind exploring therapy. And for me, that you could just be lying there, you know.
It absolutely.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I hope that it will be taken in that way.
Well, this song Wintergreen that we talked about a little earlier and played did that for me in the moment. Okay. Absolutely. And whereas whatever meditation I was doing a little earlier than that did not do that for me. It couldn't let go. Music is such a beautiful way to let go. I mean, let go, let God, the bumper sticker says, right? Hey, thank you so much for being here, both of you, John and Krishna, East Forest, and everybody. Of course, we have we'll have a bunch of links to put in there, and the guys that put the show notes together will do that. And of course, we haven't mentioned, we should, maybe we sideways mentioned the video, which was done by a group called Yes Please, arranged by John's label, and expertly done. I mean, we work with them a little bit and gave them material, but basically it's this beautiful animation of the Be Here Now Brown Pages, and this is going to be a central part of our 50th anniversary of Be Here Now, and the celebration that we're going to do in Los Angeles in October that Krishna is going to be part of. John, we don't know if you'll make it here.
We're sending a jet for you, buddy. But, yeah, don't worry
we'll
about
see.
It.
Yeah. We'll see. But you'll have this all accessible and enjoy. And again, you guys, thank you. And this is Mind Rolling on Be Here Now Network. Go to BeHereNowNetwork.com and take advantage of all the glorious podcasts, including our new Alan Watts podcast, which is, of course, Alan is spectacular, was close to Ram Dass, and it's kind of a thrill for us to have him along with the ride. And we'll see you next week. Namaste.